And now with this homegrown jet trainer, we have technologically evolved significantly. This is considered a major step for our Air Force. The training period will now be shorter and more comprehensive.
Prior to this, jet pilot training was done outside Iran, and due to Western and U.S. sanctions, Iranian pilots could not receive training abroad.
We did ask for assistance, but no country in the world helped us. However, at the end of the day, it worked out for the best because we were able to develop the technology that we needed ourselves. Knowledge-based companies help us a lot. In particular, I have to point out the design of the engine and also its aerodynamic design. All in all, Yasin is about 800 kilometers lighter than our first prototype, which is a significant achievement.
Iran started designing jet trainers over 10 years ago. Yasin is the second generation of a prototype that was unveiled in 2019. The new version now includes state-of-the-art avionics, engine, landing gear, and full cockpit devices.
With all the equipment installed, this training jet is fully equipped and it can be used for training pilots in all different levels.
But there's more to Yasin than just training fighter jet pilots.
It is also a question of prestige. This jet trainer was made by our own scientists and inventors. Knowledge-based companies played a very important part. Obviously, it means great economic benefits, but other than that, it shows that we can stand on our own feet. This is the most important message.
In the next 2 years, three more Yasin jet trainers will be produced based on the requirements of Iran's Air Force.
Iran has made great achievements in the field of aviation, and this is a symbol of self-sufficiency of the Islamic Republic. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Despite the cold winter day, a huge turnout by thousands of NHS workers and their supporters calling for action in a dispute officially about inflation matching pay, but really so much more than just that.
It's about the fighting for the heart of the NHS, because we feel this government is not committed to the principles of the NHS, which is a free, comprehensive service for all. They are privatising it by stealth, and they're hoping that it fails so that they then can do even more privatisation.
There are concerns about public safety when there are fewer workers available on strike days in a health service already at breaking point, which speaks of a deeper crisis.
Been depleted of funds, staff are leaving. NHS pay has been cut in real terms. And because of this, we're seeing staffing leaving. There's a staffing crisis. We cannot provide the care we want to give to our patients.
Similar action in recent months by nursing and ambulance unions seems to have forced the government to shift from its position on the amount of pay rises for this year, leading to some health unions to tentatively cancel strikes planned for this month. An 8-month strike wave that began last summer has seen industrial action across the public sector. Despite their impact, public support is still strong, especially for the NHS workers.
Just a regular person that loves the NHS, and I think everyone in the UK loves them, and we don't want to see the NHS in crisis.
Next week, we'll see 3 days of strikes by junior doctors who have experienced a real terms pay cut of over 26% as the costs of food, energy, and rent soar.
The demonstrators here today say while they share the concern about the impact of strike action on patients, they have to do it to safeguard the health service before it's too late. Site Tourism, London.
Iran's Shahid Rudaki warship, an unlikely but definitely meaningful location to hold the closing ceremony of the 17th International Resistance Film Festival.
Now, in these days, you know that the films are more important even than the books. So it's very important for us to make people to know about our beliefs, also our artists and our filmmakers.
It helps us to give information through movies to our children about Islam, about Palestine, people, how they suffer. Someone just see a movie and they start crying. after seeing what's happened in Palestine, in Yemen, in Syria, through movies.
In these films, or what we're doing about drama and films, we want to give message. And our message to the Israel, that if you kill him, our people, we will speak about this.
In my opinion, resistance movies are mostly about war because they show that we have to fight to survive. We have to fight for our rights. And this is the most important message of resistance movies.
Making resistance movies is not just about sending a message, which of course is an important part of the whole issue, but everything about this genre is also a challenge. Consider the special effects, the computer graphics, the stunts, the cinematography in general. This genre turns a filmmaker into an expert.
2 kilometers away off the coast, the offshore closing ceremony on the blue waters of the Persian Gulf awarded the best resistance movies in several sections, including documentaries, animations, and short and feature-length movies. As expected, The Stranger, a movie directed by Mohammad Hossein Latifi that depicts the life of the IRGC commander Mohammad Burujerdi, swept most of the awards, while The Situation of Mahdi and The Mudroom came in next. But the success of an up-and-coming young female director definitely stole the show. Leyli Aj impressed the jury with her first movie, Colonel Soraya, a must-see, according to movie critics, that depicts the notorious terrorist group MKO.
The festival has been doing very well. So as a filmmaker, I feel proud that veteran filmmakers in the jury have found my film worthy of the Best Picture Award. Now this makes my job more difficult because expectations are high.
The main reason to produce films is to bring impact to people's lives, to bring change in people's lives. As a religious student, one of the best ways to preach is to produce films.
According to Major General Hossein Salami, the chief commander of the IRGC and the keynote speaker of the closing ceremony, the Resistance Film Festival has been able to do a great job in building cultural and artistic bridges between resistance filmmakers and therefore has become a powerful tool of cultural diplomacy with a promising future.
The 17th International Resistance Film Festival has come to an end in the most memorable way, with its participants hoping that they can use cinema to inspire people across the world and promote resistance against oppression. Gisumish Ahmadi, Asaluye.
Activists gathered in Seoul to protest Japan's plan to begin releasing the radioactive contaminated water accumulating as a result of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. The demonstration comes as the region marks the 12th anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, with several nations, including China, protesting Tokyo's plan.
Japan's neighbors, including China, South Korea, North Korea, and Russia, as well as Pacific Island countries, have repeatedly expressed concerns and firm opposition to Japan's plan to discharge the nuclear-contaminated wastewater into the sea.
On March 11, 2011, a tsunami flooded the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, causing the meltdowns of 3 reactors. 150,000 people were evacuated. The disaster caused nuclear-reliant countries to rethink energy policies. Under previous President Moon Jae-in, South Korea had been moving to phase out nuclear energy. Now, under President Yoon Suk-yeol, the country has reversed course with plans to increase nuclear energy production to more than 30% of the total by 2030. South Koreans demonstrating in Seoul oppose the country's return to nuclear energy reliance. South Korea is not only renewing old reactors, but restarting construction on new reactors and building nuclear power plants for other countries.
Energy policies centered on nuclear power are being misrepresented as a solution to the safety of the people and the climate crisis. The lifespan of old nuclear power plants across the country, including Busan Gori No. 1, is being extended without regard for safety, and the region is in danger of becoming a nuclear waste site.
South Korea is developing a nuclear waste problem with existing spent fuel storage set to reach full capacity within 10 years. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After a year spent in Ukraine covering the ongoing conflict with Russia, Italian freelance journalists Andrea Ceresini and Alfredo Bosco returned to Italy a couple of weeks ago on advice of Italy's foreign ministry. The two had the press accreditation suspended by the Ukrainian authorities while they were returning from the Bakhmut front in early February. For weeks, they were unable to work, awaiting interrogation by the Ukrainian security service. Both journalists claim the Kiev's decision was unfounded.
Ukrainian authorities have never explained to us why our press accreditation was suspended. What we know is that both of us carried out independent reports in Ukraine and in the republics of Donetsk and Luhansk between 2014 and 2015. At least two other Italian journalists have received the same treatment. On our Fixes chats, there were talks that we had been collaborating with the Russians, that we were spies. It would have been really dangerous to stay in Ukraine for us.
Some Italian media have reported that at least eight Italian journalists have been blacklisted by the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense over the past weeks. According to the two journalists, Ceresini and Bosco, all of them had reported from the Donbas region in previous years.
C'è rimasta un'esperienza un po' di delusione.
We thought a solution could have been found during Italy's Prime Minister Meloni visit to Kiev last month. We were ready to discuss our situation with the Ukrainian authorities. It goes without saying that we are disappointed.
Andrea Ceresini is an expert on far-right terrorism in Italy's 70s. He has been freelancing for a number of authoritative Italian broadcasters and newspapers from many areas of crisis, including Egypt and Venezuela. Alfredo Bosco established himself for his photo reportage on Mexico's drug cartels and 2010's Haiti's cholera outbreak.
Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has yet to comment on the suspension of the two journalists' press accreditation by the Ukrainian authorities, nor has she ever expressed support for them. Rome has been a staunch supporter of Kyiv since the beginning of the war in Ukraine over a year ago. Max Civili, Rome.
Introducing a new role model by outlining the most important characteristics. The third model for women may be the answer to women's woes, and what better occasion to discuss this global issue than International Women's Day. The concept of the third model for women was presented initially on March 6, 2012, by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And now academics and researchers participating in an international congress held in Tehran have taken the opportunity to shed more light on this new concept.
In order to present this new role model and to explain its different dimensions, we must allow a scientific discourse to take place. Therefore, we must first theorize the two models that exist, namely the Western narrative of women and the Eastern viewpoint. Then we can create a platform for promoting the third model, which is the Muslim women.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution presented this concept about 10 years ago, and by holding this conference, we want to promote third model for women to the elite in order to design a comprehensive plan of action. We should start with articles, books and meetings, and then we can move forward.
According to the foreign participants of the conference, the issue of the status of women in today's world is a complicated one, and practical examples are necessary to understand the concept. One faculty member in particular raised an interesting point.
In Iran, women clearly play an important role in the society, and women are active in all different aspects of social life. Many of them are known worldwide. So I think that if we're looking for practical examples of this concept, all we need to do is look at the Iranian society.
In the East, traditionally women have been sidelined, and in the West they are mostly exploited for political and economic gains. But Islam presents a different viewpoint. Iranian women and Iranian Muslim women in particular reflect the teachings of Islam and how Islam defines women. They are active members of the community. This is quite evident in the Iranian society.
Reflecting the true image of Iranian women while highlighting their achievements is a necessary step that needs to be taken.
Ayatollah Khamenei believes that in the Islamic school of thought, women play an exceptional role in the society, and therefore he presents a new and more realistic model. Very different from the Western capitalist and the Eastern sidelined and passive woman. The third model is the Iranian Muslim woman, an active member of the society who has opened a new chapter in history. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Britain's economy has faced many challenges in recent years. The withdrawal of the country from the European Union and the expenses caused by the control of the coronavirus pandemic caused the economy to be about 20% smaller than in 2020. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, rejected calls to prevent sharp rises in domestic energy bills for all households in his March budget, meaning millions of Britons will see costs soar by about 40% from April. Instead, Jeremy Hunt will claim the extra support he's giving to the poorest and most vulnerable households, including those on benefits, in what he will describe as a more fairly targeted system of support. Demands for the Treasury to halt a planned rise in the energy price guarantee, the discounted cost of gas and electricity to consumers from £2,500 to £3,000 a year for the average household in the March budget have been growing in recent weeks, particularly as the whole wholesale cost of energy has been falling. Because an additional £400 of extra government help with energy costs for all households made in monthly payments since October also ends in March, the effective rise for all but those under lowest incomes will be about 40%. Calls for the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, to stop the rise in the energy price guarantee have been led by consumer champion Martin Lewis, founder of the website MoneySavingExpert.com, who has said the move would be an obvious rabbit out of the hat that the Chancellor could afford to pull out of his red box in March. The Labour Party, meanwhile, has also been calling for the rise in the energy price guarantee to be stopped and for the extra cost to the government of doing so to be met through the proceeds of a more punitive windfall tax on the vast profits of energy companies. But Treasury insiders have told The Observer that the move is not under consideration, partly because Treasury receipts from its own windfall tax on energy companies have been less than expected, and because of worries about exposing taxpayers to future market rise. Ruling out the move, a Treasury source said, While gas prices have fallen in recent months, they are still 5 times higher than the historical average and can just as easily increase. The source added, if the gas price spikes, the government will need to borrow billions of pounds more, while the energy price guarantee will continue to insulate millions of households from even higher wholesale gas prices. We need to reduce the taxpayer exposure to market volatility. Insulating every household and on an open-ended basis could have major implications for the public finances. Officials said that at the time of the autumn statement last November, the Treasury's own estimate for the proceeds of the windfall tax over 5 years was £55 billion. But because of recent falls in energy prices, this total has fallen by £25 billion and was now anticipated to come in closer to £30 billion. Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves said, the prospect of such steep rises for most households was frightening and shameful at a time when energy giants were reaping huge profits. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a report, households in England and Wales will see the largest increase to their water bills in almost 20 years from this April, when they rise to an average of £448 a year. Industry body Water UK said the 7.5% increase would see customers pay around £1.23 per day on average, an increase of 8 pence per day, or an average of £31 more on last year's charges. Consumer groups warned the rise could prove the tipping point for 1 in 5 customers already struggling to pay. But Water UK claimed the water bills remained lower in real terms than they were a decade ago and said this year's increase reflected higher energy costs, with water firms using around 2% of the nation's electricity. It announced firms were set to invest a further £70 billion to eliminate harm from storm overflows and increase water supplies by building new reservoirs and national water transfer schemes, claiming that they were acutely aware of the impact of price rises on lower income and vulnerable customers and had recently increased the level of support they offered by more than £200 million. Water UK Director of Policy Stuart Colville said, with an average increase of around 60 pence a week, most customers will again see a below-inflation increase in their water bill. However, we know that any increase is unwelcome, particularly at the moment. The Consumer Council for Water announced regional variations and factors such as whether a customer is metered and how much water they use meant some households could face rises significantly above or below the average. The Consumer Council for Water Chief Executive Emma Clancy said, water is essential for all of us, so no one should be worried about being able to afford their bill. These increases will bring more uncertainty to struggling households at a time when they can't be certain that they will get the help that they need. Emma Clancy added, low-income households need immediate relief and the long-term security of knowing their water bill will be affordable. It is not fair that struggling households face a postcode lottery when it comes to getting help with their water bill. That's why we urgently need a new water affordability scheme that provides consistent support based on people's needs. The website msn.com has also covered the same story and tells us more. The impending recession could leave borrowers struggling to repay their debts, the High Street Bank Santander UK said, as it put aside more cash to protect itself from potential defaults. The UK arm of the Spanish bank said recently that while the outlook for Britain's economy remained uncertain, a recession in 2023 was likely. It said that despite government support for energy bills, rising prices would continue to eat away at disposable income, which could impact lending repayments. The warning was issued alongside the bank's full-year results, which showed the lender put aside £321 million in 2022 to cover potential defaults, compared with the £233 million it released a year earlier as COVID restrictions began to lift. The higher figure was because of the deterioration in the economic environment, including higher interest rates, lower economic growth, and a drop in house prices, which Santander predicts will fall by about 10% to levels not seen since 2021. The bank said these challenges for households and businesses are expected to continue into 2023 and could impact credit quality, referring to the ability of borrowers to repay their loans and mortgages. On Wednesday, Virgin Money set aside £66 million to cover a possible rise in bad debts in the first quarter of this year. However, the Challenger Bank said repayments had been stable so far. Santander's provision for potential defaults weighed on the lender's profits, which rose just 2% to nearly £1.9 billion over the year to December. The flat growth was despite a 12% increase in net interest income to £4.5 billion, as the interest rate rise allowed it to charge more for mortgages and loans. Profits were also subdued by the £421 million it put aside to cover the cost of fraud and scams, as well as a £108 million regulatory fine from the Financial Conduct Authority. In December, the UK regulator issued the bank with a penalty over serious and persistent gaps in its anti-money laundering controls between 2012 and 2017. Santander UK said it was also affected by a marked slowdown in mortgage lending at the end of the year as interest rates increased to 3.5%.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. The collapse of the unipolar world is on the horizon, which is a backdrop for many global political maneuvers taking place today. Tensions have been rising between the United States and China. Beijing had tried to de-escalate the situation and call for cooler heads. However, Washington seems that it is not backing down, as it's increasing tensions with China over Taiwan and also targeting Chinese tech companies. And now Beijing has just played a key role in brokering talks between Iran and Saudi Arabia to the disdain of Washington. Well, will this tug of war between China and the United States turn into a real war, or will there be some compromise in the multipolar world that is arising? Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Hubert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels. And Jim Kavanaugh, writer and political commentator out of New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both of you to the program. Well, let me start this off with Gilbert in Brussels. I mean, originally the Chinese had called for measures to reduce tensions with the U.S., but on Sunday, President Xi's calling for a great wall of steel when referring to China's military. What do you think he means by that?
Well, first, the historical reference is clear. He's making a reference to the Great Wall, which was the single most important engineering feat of its time, and which protected China from the barbarians, from those outside its core territory with its homogeneous population. The reference here is very important, and it's not accidental, and it's not just decorative because it makes reference to the Great Wall. I think it gives us a clear indication of what the military ambitions and priorities are of China, that is, to establish its presence and to exclude the presence of the United States from the first island chain in the South China Sea. The issue that's very interesting, this is what he said, because he's not calling attention to Taiwan. I don't think the Chinese have any intention of invading Taiwan, because that is a major major military project with great risks. What is the long-term interest of China is to keep the United States at a distance.
Well, Gilbert, let me just jump in with what you've just said, because you said you don't think that China would invade or react in dealing with Taiwan. Do you not think that Taiwan is one of China's red lines?
Yes, but the United States is not going to take over Taiwan. The United States is doing everything possible to provoke China to a premature invasion or hostile act against Taiwan. A substantial part of the Taiwanese population favors eventual reunification with China. The Chinese are playing a long game. They understand this, and they have no reason to be precipitate. The United States would like them to do something similar to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, so that they can marshal all of their allies, including the new AUKUS alliance, the NATO of the Pacific, to isolate and to destroy China economically.
Okay,
and hopefully
stay with me, Gilbert. Let me get Jim in on this conversation. Jim, you were shaking your head a lot during Gilbert's comments. Let's start from there. Do you agree or disagree with what he's saying?
And I agree the Chinese actually don't want to invade Taiwan. But on the other hand, I think they are not going to let Taiwan become de facto or de jure, but de facto a military base and cat's paw of the United States, and de facto an independent entity, state entity that acts and is treated by the United States as such, especially for military purposes. So it is like Ukraine and Russia in the sense that they saw what the United States did with Ukraine, and they're seeing it do the same thing with Taiwan, and not just Taiwan. The United States is building up military infrastructure in the region. Biden has vowed to turn the word vowed to turn China, Japan into a potent military force. They're talking about ballistic missiles for Japan. That's, you know, there's a history to that. You know, so you got, they're putting bases in the Philippines. You have the American military commander saying we're going to be at war in China with China within 2 years or 3 years. So the question of whether China wants to invade Taiwan, and I agree that the United States would like them to do this precipitously, but on the other hand, they're going to create a situation. They very well might create a situation where China, the people of China feels like they can't allow Taiwan to become even more de facto an independent country, and an independent country which is a base for American hegemony in the Pacific region. So it's not out of question that China at some point would say there's a red line that's been crossed. And, you know, they're building up their military. They're not going to allow the United States to turn Taiwan into an independent independent state.
Jim, sorry to interrupt you. Just thinking about what you've just said, though, tell me why, in your perspective, why is the United States doing what it is doing? It's already overstretched, dealing with so many different places, and especially now with this war with Ukraine. I mean, it really, does Washington want to take on China? Or is it like Gilbert said, it's just that they're poking at them, trying to get reaction? I mean, what's going on here in your perspective, Jim?
Well, ultimately, the United States wants to prevent China from displacing it as the hegemonic power in the Pacific region, let's put it that way. And, you know, it can't do it. I don't understand I'm flabbergasted at what they think they can do. I mean, they go to China and say, you can't sell weapons to Russia. What are you talking about? The United States can sell hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons to Ukraine, and China's not allowed to sell a rifle to Russia? Do they think the Chinese actually afraid of them in some way? So it's very dangerous. You know, as I say, American commanders are saying we're going to be at war. I had a friend who's at a think tank in Washington last week, and he went to some Federal Reserve Board meeting or a meeting about economics, and they were all talking about we're going to be in war with China within 2 years. It's as, you know, it's become a kind of mantra that they're getting people used to. And I just don't understand what all they can do is what they've done in Ukraine. Is turn Taiwan into a bloodbath, and all they can do, is therefore delay or damage China, where they thought they could damage Russia, and they are damaging Russia in such a way that it's going to prevent its rise into a hegemonic power.
Okay.
Good luck, but no, it's not going to happen.
Well, Gilbert, your take. I mean, in dealing, if we look at the American elite. Because there seems to be a detachment between the elite and the average American. I'm sure the average American does not want to even think of war. But the elite, is it that they are so afraid of this hegemon losing power, as Jim said, that they would rather actually cause a bloodbath or more war and terror, but just to think that they can hold on to power, but they would do that? I mean, how do you see it?
Well, you used the word the average American, and I would think that the average American would simply prefer not to think. When you speak about the elites, it's a different question. They are thinking overtime, and the neoconservative thinkers, starting with the State Department, Madame Nuland, they are thinking 24 hours a day, and it's amazing that their thoughts are insane. My fellow Palinist is looking for a logic. You cannot find a logic in insanity. The United States has managed and continues up to the present day to push Russia and China together. These were not natural allies, but they have become so for self-preservation and to resist the obnoxious, aggressive behavior of the United States, which is to humiliate them. In this situation, the Chinese will not be looking to invade Taiwan because that would be playing into American hands. Their policy will be to continue to build their navy, which is now the largest in the world, and to ensure that at any moment they are capable of imposing a blockade on Taiwan and an air blockade on Taiwan, and forcing the Republic to heal without shedding any blood. Now, who would oppose that? The United States, with its navy in the South China Sea, which the Chinese will be able to sink in 10 minutes. And I think they understand that. Pentagon.
Just, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, what you're saying, they're on the other side of the world, and we're talking about this huge naval force, the Chinese. I mean, I don't know, is it a serious drug trip or just total insanity or what? Who is behind this strategy in thinking that the Americans can come out victorious with such a plan? I mean, what's your thought, Gilbert, on this?
Hubris. They are overconfident. They are cocky. They still believe the world is in 1991, and they have not opened their eyes. The policies of the State Department, of U.S. foreign policy, and the military program, they are all living in a bell jar. They are not facing the realities of the world. There are, I don't mean to say no one is facing it, of course. There are some realists, there are some people who understand the risks. But the policy is being written by ideologues. Madame Nuland is the wife of Robert Kagan, who was the chief, one of the chief thinkers in the neoconservative movement, one of the first to call for the invasion of Iraq. And they have never looked back. They have not looked in the rearview mirror. It's been one catastrophe after another. What they're doing is totally illogical. You in Iran, your presence, security, the fact that you are under the protection, and I would say even the nuclear umbrella, of both China and Russia. This is a direct result of the United States' blind ideological foreign policy, which was aimed, they thought, at harming you, but in fact have made you safer than ever. The major movers in this new alignment of the world order are China, Russia, and yourselves, Iran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And speaking of, we'll look at Iran and China. Jim, I want to look at the agreement that was recently reached with the Chinese mediating between Iran and Saudi Arabia. How do you think that this play in, how do you think Washington is seeing this type of move? Because China has put itself in the position of an international player, of a broker that I guess both sides could trust. Washington is unable to do that anymore and with so many countries. I mean, your assessment of this and what does this mean to the United States?
Yeah, I'll say quickly, just I want to say that I think there's more of a chance of a war with nuclear weapons in Iran before China. Because I think the Israelis are desperate to attack Iran. I think the Americans, for all the reasons, as Gilbert says, the neoconservatives think they can get away with anything. They don't believe, and nobody said, that Iran is under the nuclear protection of China and Russia. And if there is a war in Iran, if the Americans and Israel attack Iran, Israel will use nuclear weapons. That's my opinion. And that is as likely to happen as any war with China. But in terms of what happened with China in Iran and Saudi Arabia, China demonstrated that it is a powerful player. It's asserting a kind of counter-hegemony. It's asserting its ability to do diplomacy. Amazing. This thing that the United States kind of thinks is about threats and bullying, China gets two countries together and has them talk it out and make a deal. And China's able to do that. And the threat that poses, that the Israelis are terrified of, one of the reasons they may foment attack on Iran, is that, you know, they're dependent on the United States to control everything in the Middle East. And that's starting to get lost. And what you see is the general strategy of China versus the United States. China didn't go in there with building military bases and
supporting moderate rebels and trying to overthrow governments. They went in, they go to countries, they make deals, they build infrastructure, and they respect people, and they respect differences, and they're able to sit down and moderate differences. That's a huge thing in principle. I don't quite trust Saudi Arabia entirely in this, but something has happened that's changed the game in a way that is very fearful for Israel particularly.
Well, what about that? You said, Jim, something has happened. Is it that you think, for example, Riyadh is also conscious of this major shift that is taking, going from the west to the east, and basically want to cover all sides and make sure that they don't lose out? I mean, is it that you think?
Yes. You know, there was also talk of Riyadh now, of Saudi Arabia now accepting other currencies than the dollar for their oil transactions, which would be a big thing. And, you know, as Gilbert said, you know, the Americans are partying like it's 1999. He said 1991, but I'll go with the Prince talk. When it's not, Russia and China now are more powerful economically and militarily. And Saudi Arabia and Iran and these countries can see what's going on in the world. And they don't, you know, they don't want to be turned in to Ukraine. They don't want to have a situation where their foreign reserves are stolen by the United States because they're in dollars. The United States has done more to overturn its financial hegemony in the world by taking Russia's foreign reserves than any revolutionary party in the world has done. Every country in the world is looking and said, we've got to get out of this, because if we do something they don't like, and I guarantee you the Americans will find a lot of things in Saudi Arabia that they don't like, we'll take your money because you have it in dollars. So everybody is seeing this has to change. And the Chinese have, with a lot of work, established themselves as, you know, real honest players who can be trusted, and they have power. And so there are ultimate centers of power that have proven themselves more trustworthy, and that is ultimately, you know, going to undermine the hegemony of the United States.
Hmm. Well, what about that, Gilbert? We were talking about Israel, and I want to look at that and how they have looked at this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and the role that China has played. But also, because Jim had touched on and saying that actually Iran is more at risk today. But your take on that, isn't it that if they could have done it, they would have done it already? Because there have been so many threats from, my God, from how many years ago, from whether we're talking about Tel Aviv or even Washington, isn't it also that Iran is not the Iran of the 90s either? Go ahead, Gilbert.
That's correct. That's correct. But I'd like to jump in and add another dimension to China's activity as a broker and peacemaker between Saudi Arabia and Iran. China is not just a disinterested party here. China is a very interested party. China is the world's largest importer of oil. And Saudi Arabia is the largest exporter of oil. Iran is a major exporter of oil. These two countries have been in hostile relations for some time, and that has put China in a very embarrassing situation of being compelled by one or the other to take sides. It doesn't want to take sides, because whichever side it takes, it will lose the other side, which is important to its energy balance and to stability in a part of the world that is providing its energy. So China was a very interested party in reaching this agreement, and that is all to the good, because it makes the agreement all the more solid, and both Saudi and Iran are benefiting from this reduction of tension in their region. As to Israel striking Iran, I agree with your assessment that this could have taken place many years ago if Israel felt that it had the backing of the United States, because by itself, it cannot do it. It requires United States support of various kinds, intelligence and satellite coverage and all sorts of support. It didn't get that backing in the past, and there's no reason to see it coming in the present, least of all when Israel is doing badly on Capitol Hill.
China appears, I talked about at the beginning of the show, that it may be running out of patience. And What do you think the actual red lines for Beijing is with the United States? Because we know there's been sanctions. We know how the Chinese tech companies have been actually under attack. But what are the major red lines, you think, for Beijing in dealing with the U.S.?
Just say quickly, the United States did agree to attack Iran, and it was only called off 10 minutes beforehand by Donald Trump. And if he hadn't done that, would be well, that would have happened. And he was roundly criticized for it. It was the most effective anti-militarist act by a president since John Kennedy did not send air power into the Bay of Pigs, and it was as radical, if not more so. What are China's red lines? China's red lines are any kind of political direct attempt for independence of Taiwan, okay? China's red lines are they're going to judge whether the military buildup that the Americans are doing with Taiwan in terms of giving them arms, giving them training, putting American soldiers on the ground in Taiwan, which they're already doing, becomes for them crosses a critical mass that is turning Taiwan into the de facto NATO base that Ukraine was, for example. As Ukraine itself said, we are a de facto NATO base, as the Europeans and the NATO people said, we've been building them up into a NATO base since 2014. So at some point, if China thinks that that's happened and it's gotten beyond a certain, they're going to have to say, you know, we will not allow Taiwan to be put in a situation where we can't reunify it. Mm-hmm. And we know that de facto we're being excluded from ever reunifying it. That's a hard thing to judge, and I don't know when it's going to happen. But certainly any declaration of independence on the part of Taiwan would be a red line.
Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this Spotlight. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels, Jim Kavanaugh, writer and political commentator out of New York. Thank you both. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, thanking you and all the crew, from myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.